on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. The Baltimore-based author Paul Valentine is a former reporter for The Washington Post. He's just published his third novel, which takes place in rural North Carolina 2 years after the death of Martin Luther King Jr. The protagonist, Arliss Morrow, is a white newspaper reporter who is searching for a black childhood friend he hasn't seen for 30 years. Along the way, he encounters a cast of pretty eccentric characters, and he uncovers disturbing facts about his family's past. It's a book about the large issues of race and class in the context of a small town in the American South. It's called The Road to Goshen Shoals, and Paul Valentine joins me in the studio. It's great to meet you.
Good to see you.
So the setting of this book is almost a character in itself. Tell us about Goshen Shoals and the area in which this book takes place.
It's a small, isolated, bleak county in the central part of North Carolina called the Piedmont, and it has traditionally been that parts of the Piedmont have traditionally been very poor. And this book, a story set in 1970, when the poverty was still much more extensive than it is today.
And it was a mixed community, black and white.
Yes, it was mixed, although it was. At least the county that I'm describing in the novel, which is a fictitious county, is predominantly white. It has a small black population, and there's a historical reason for that. That is that it was so soil there was so poor that farming was not particularly beneficial, and so there were no large plantations which would have lots of slaves. And so the blacks who do live in this fictitious county as of today are not so much the blacks from the Civil War, pre-Civil War time, but post-Civil War who migrated there and lived on small plots of land scattered through the county.
Mm-hmm. So in this rural environment, if agriculture isn't the main thing, the main occupation, what is? How do folks make a living?
Well, it's hard scrabble. They do the best they can, small businesses, small jobs, hiring out to the town, whatever jobs are available in the town to keep the infrastructure of the town going. And it's people move around a great deal from one job to another. There's a great deal of instability.
So your main protagonist, like yourself, is a newspaper reporter. He's in his early to mid-30s. Tell us a little bit about Arliss Morrow.
Arliss Morrow is a character I've created. I wouldn't say it's autobiographical, but he is certainly a young white reporter of what would back in the 1970s would have been called the New South. He was young enough to have gone or old enough to have gone through a considerable period of official legal racial segregation, and then came the Civil Rights Movement and the passage of various civil rights laws, which brought an end to formal or legal segregation. And he was part of that whole transition and is trying to figure it out, its impact and on both white people and black people in the years after the major civil rights legislation.
So he grew up in this county in which the novel takes place, but he's returning. He has since left home and has been living in the big city.
Exactly. He makes it out of this bleak a remote county by going to the University of North Carolina. And from there, with a degree, he's able to get a job as a newspaper in the state's capital of Raleigh. And then he returns to the county, not permanently. He is had to return because his mother died. And on her deathbed, she had asked him to try to find a black kid that Arliss had known when he and the kid were both about 5 or 6 years old, that is to say before they went off to their separate public schools. And in the intervening 30 years, the dying mother, for her own reasons that are not clear to Arliss or to anyone else, wants Arliss to find him and see what's happened to him in the intervening 30 years.
So his character as a child was named Jesse. His name changes by the time we finally meet him. Most of the book is spent in searching for him.
Yeah.
And so he's motivated. Arliss is motivated by his mom and her curiosity, but he's also got some questions of his own, doesn't he?
He certainly does have questions of his own, and those questions are largely informed by the changes in the civil rights laws, or the changes brought on by the civil rights laws, because it's essentially changed the relationship between blacks and whites. Traditionally, you know, the relationship was one where the white power structure dictated the relationship. And with the new laws, that old structure was starting to disintegrate, and a new, more equitable arrangement was developing, but it was still very much in formation in 1970.
I'm Tom Hall. My guest this morning, Paul Valentine. His new book is called The Road to Goshen Shoals. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1. Talk a little bit about the impact of the death of Dr. King in the rural South, not in the cities. We know that rioting broke out almost immediately in the large cities in America. But you're talking about 1970, rural North Carolina. The Civil Rights Act is now 5 years old, and then Dr. King is murdered in 1968. There was a different reaction in the rural parts of the country than there was in the cities, to some extent.
Yeah, I would say so. In the first place, because the population itself is much more dispersed and sparse, the reaction was muted. The black population was so scattered that it didn't have the sense of unity in large numbers that formed in the cities, in the urban centers. And the white population had differing reactions, ranging from honest sadness at the death of Dr. King to one of general gladness. I mean, it was a tremendous range, and there were still, even in 1970, fragments of the old Ku Klux Klan structure and neo-Nazi organizations which saw this as an opportunity to rally more support for them. And that was sort of more the atmosphere in the rural areas of the South.
Are you yourself a son of the South? I'm wondering how you put yourself in the mind of, African Americans at that time period in that rural setting.
I am a son of the South in the sense that I was literally born in central North Carolina. However, as a quirk there, because my parents were not from North Carolina. They were outliers. My mother was from Brooklyn, and my father was from New York State, and they both, after they were married, they moved to Detroit, where my father was an engineer for Ford Motor Company. He gets laid off in the Depression years and is promised a job in North Carolina by one of his brothers, so he moves to North Carolina with his wife, and who was then pregnant with me in the mid-1930s. And so I was born in small town North Carolina essentially as an outsider, and brought up with that, seeing the South through that lens, which is very different from being a more typical son of the South.
Sure. Did you have any misgivings or any nervousness, I suppose I'd call it, about, writing black characters as a white guy?
Indeed, I did. I was never 100% confident that I was reflecting or giving a correct or authentic reflection of black thinking, of black decision-making, and black characterizations in general. I wrote the book more or less on my own without sort of consulting with any other, black colleagues in my line of work. But after I finished it, I did send it around to a couple of long trusted black friends of mine who read it. And I was very relieved that they told me that it did read to them as an authentic story and correctly reflected the very, very ambiguous and complex thinking of both white people and black people, and that complexity was especially noticeable when the blacks and whites were talking to each other.
Sure. This is a self-published book.
Yes.
And I wonder, is that a purposeful decision on yours? Did you send it to agents and to publishers? Did you make the decision on your own to self-publish?
It's a long, tangled history, and to make that story a short one, my first book, which I published or had published in 1989, was published in the typical fashion through a bricks and mortar publishing company in New York. And then I wrote a second novel two or three years after that. And my editor in New York didn't like it. We had an amicable parting of the ways, but I lost my contacts with the sort of publishing world and the literary agency world, and with the loss of that, and also with the more recent arrival of self-publishing and the diminishing of traditional publishing houses in New York and elsewhere. Self-publishing became...
The moment was right, yeah.
Became the option.
Of course, when you do this without an editor, of course, Frank DeFord, I always loved his comment about editors. I mean, he's, on National Public Radio, but wrote for years for Sports Illustrated and many other publications. He said every editor should have a pimp for a brother so he'd have someone to look up to. He was not a fan of editors. But you're doing this without an editor, and that's a very different experience for a writer, writing a whole,
It is a very different experience. However, that difference is diminished slightly by the fact that I had 35, 38 years in the journalistic world as a reporter, where my work was closely edited every day. And I was used to going through through the whole process of having my whatever I was writing vetted very carefully for all kinds of entirely reasonable, proper reasons, and so I'm accustomed to being edited, and I know what kinds of edits to do. In fact, you sort of pick up the habits as you go along. I mean, there's sort of two levels of editing. One is your grammar, your syntax, your punctuation, the mechanics of editing, and the other one is the more cerebral, big brush, broad brush sort of approach to storytelling, and I got a very good dose of the first and a fairly good dose of the second.
What was your beat at the Post?
I covered law enforcement, cops, courts, prisons, law enforcement policy, that kind of thing was my specialty. And I had other – we all did general assignment, but those are my specialties.
Yeah, a couple of cops in this book, but it's interesting. This is somewhat a departure from that professional endeavor.
Indeed,
that's for sure.
Indeed.
Well, Paul Valentine, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much, and good luck with the book.
Thank you so much.
Paul Valentine, his latest book is called The Road to Goshen Shoals. He'll be speaking about the book tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Govens branch of the Enoch Pratt Library. We'll have a link to more information on our website. Come on over to WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. That's it for us today. Coming up Friday on the program, I'll take a tour of the new exhibit at the Reginald F. Lewis Museum of Maryland African American History and Culture with its director, Dr. Skip Saunders, and the beatboxer Shodake, who has created audio installations as part of that exhibition. Hope you can join us Friday morning on Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WIPR, in Baltimore. Come to our website to learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed. Again, the address is WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Our director and engineer is Nathan Sterner. We've got production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer. For Sheila Cast, I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.